150 years ago, the land you're on today belonged to Russia. The sale of this vast territory to the United States was a major source of angst for Russians who wondered if Tsar Alexander II was crazy, and a source of irritation for Americans who wondered if William H. Seward was a kook for buying it, referring to the purchase as Seward's folly. Today, Russians are still sore about losing the land, and Alaskans are marking the sesquicentennial. We've got the author of two new books on both men here today for Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The man who sold Alaska, Tsar Alexander II of Russia, and the man who bought Alaska, William H. Seward, are the titles of two books published recently to document the history of the men behind the real estate deal that created the state we live in today. Mike Dunham has worked as a reporter in Alaska for a long time, stretching back to the Anchorage Times, then the Anchorage Daily News, and the Alaska Dispatch. Now he can add historical biographer to his bio if it's not already there. Welcome, Mike.
Hello.
Thanks so much for coming in today. I want to break the show into two halves like you've divided the books. The first half hour we'll discuss the Tsar, and the second half hour we'll talk about Seward. You can also join our conversation if you have questions or comments about the historical men we're discussing today. You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us questions, talk@alaskapublic.org. Sesquicentennial. I wouldn't want to have to say that a whole bunch of times fast because it's a mouthful.
100 and a half.
100 and a half. It's right. A much better way to say it. So, Mike, tell us how it is that you came to this project in the first place.
Well, I got a cold call from the publisher, Flip Todd, who said, I've got this idea for a couple of books, and I think you're the person to write it. And he described the books to me, and I knew something about Seward. I knew nothing about Alexander. And then he described the way he wanted the covers to look. And he said, I wanted you to find a couple of photos of the two guys so they'll be facing each other on the covers. And at that point, I realized Flip knows something about marketing that I probably didn't, and this might be a good idea. And also, he insisted that the books be quite short, which I understood. A lot of books are sold to tourists in Alaska, and Alaskans really don't have access to short things either. What I didn't realize as I stepped into the project was that this was apparently the first biography of William Seward written by any Alaskan, and I think it's the first biography of Alexander written by an American. The way these stories are told are somewhat different than the standard biographies or histories. They center around the acquisition of Russian claims in North America by the United States of America. I hesitate to use the terms bought and sold. Mm. They turn up on the cover, and there's a marketing reason for that. It's an easy way to describe
sure.
it. But I'm always trying to be a little bit – I mean, Russia had not seen most of Alaska at that point in time. They had no idea what was here. They had – nobody did. And except the people who were actually living here.
Well, in that vein – before we get to that question, I wanted to ask about why you decided, and maybe it's just purely a Flip Todd marketing idea, but why two separate books instead of covering them both in one?
Well, I think, first of all, you can make the books shorter. I think they appeal to slightly different markets, even though they're on the same topic. These two men never met each other. Almost everybody else in both books met each other at some point. But these two guys actually never crossed paths, and their stories are quite different. I think it would have been very difficult for me to try and weave the Tsar's career in with Seward's. They touched in places, but they were not by any means parallel.
They did share some common moral beliefs that we'll explore later on as far as slavery and serfdom.
Yes.
But I wanted to ask about the remarkable reach that Russia had in into the 1700s. Tell us about all the territory that they claimed.
It was pretty astonishing that the Duchy of Moscow had grown to encompass a huge chunk of Eastern Europe, mainly under Ivan the Terrible, whose name really doesn't translate as terrible in Russian, and then Peter the Great, who were able to achieve great success with huge armies, basically. There was a big population there, and once they got organized and armed with guns, they were formidable. Peter actually had the largest navy on the face of the earth when he was czar. And then they began to push east as well, taking the Khanates and the Stans sort of one by one, reaching finally all the way to the Pacific Ocean, mm-hmm. and then sending Bering across to make claims in North America when they finally figured out it was North America. And under Baranov, they began to expand even into California with Fort Ross and a fort temporarily, not very well established in Hawaii. The Hawaiians put an end to that pretty quickly. But that empire stretched around the world, literally. And as far as actually compact government units, it may have been the biggest ever. Perhaps China under the Khans was somewhat larger. And perhaps South America when it was all under Spanish control, but it never was. I mean, Brazil was always part of Portugal. I mean, they may have been the largest empire in history. The British Empire was bigger, but they were scattered bits and pieces overseas. I mean, a continent, yeah, but it wasn't attached to Britain. Mm-hmm. Everything in Russia was attached to Russia, and that gave it a certain amount of both power, but also some inertia. They could they were always trying to get to oceans so they could launch a real fleet. And they were always blocked there, basically, by Turkey.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are discussing two new books on the sesquicentennial, the 150th anniversary of the sale of Alaska from Russia to the United States. And we're talking with author Mike Dunham, who is a longtime reporter in Alaska and is the author of these two new books on both men, the Tsar of Russia, Tsar Alexander II, and William H. Seward. A lot is known about Seward, but how difficult was it to research Tsar Alexander II?
Surprisingly difficult. As I said, there's no English language biographies on him. There is one English translation of a Russian biography that's currently available, a modern biography. There are a couple of lovely Hollywood-style movies about his life, particularly his love affair with a schoolgirl. And they've been produced in Austria and France, and they're all about 50 years old at this point in time. But maybe it's time for a remake of those exciting stories. But I wound up having to find bits and pieces about him in larger books about other topics in general, such as socialism, the rise of socialism, or the end of serfdom. You would find mentions of him in there and start bringing this all together.
So you had to just piece it together from a lot of different sources.
Right. Yeah, it was somewhat different. I couldn't get to Russia to do any kind of firsthand research on it. But there are – he's mentioned prominently in a lot of 19th century literature, including Mark Twain's Innocents Abroad. Mark Twain met him and liked him. It was a very interesting touch because we all know who Mark Twain is. It's a guy who could be sitting at the radio station right now and educating us all. And his opinion I placed very highly in writing the book.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment about the two new books on the sale and the purchase of Alaska from the perspective of Tsar Alexander II and William H. Seward. And we've got author Mike Dunham in the studio with us. He's written the two books. 550-8422, 550-8422 is the number in Anchorage, and talk@alaskapublic.org is the email address if you'd like to send your questions in that way. The Tsar Alexander II was smitten with young Queen Victoria, but ended up marrying another woman. Tell us why this relationship couldn't work.
Well, he was sent to Europe as a young man to find a suitable bride, and he travels all the way to England. He wasn't actually looking for a bride when he went to England. He was checking it out because of relatives and also just to make the political connections. You know, I'm going to have to deal with these people. And yes, he and Queen Victoria fell head over heels in love with each other. Her diaries are our main source about this. And, they would dance all night, and then she would lay in bed wide awake until the wee hours. And the palace gossip was that if he popped the question, she was going to say yes. And this meant ultimately the heads of state, two major states that often fought with each other, would be married. If you're in love, this means nothing. If you're a politician, you're thinking, this is horrible. We cannot do this. So, and fortunately, Alexander's father, Nicholas I, who was a real tyrant in all kinds of ways, wanted to manage everything. He certainly did not want the strong-willed, independent-minded queen monarch of a rival nation to be the Tsarina. One of them was going to have to give up something. He said, you know, son, you can't do this. You know, give it up. And so he went with a German princess who was very shallow and very obedient. And Nicholas liked her a lot.
Tsar Alexander II was named for his uncle, and he was really groomed for a long time to be a leader. What did your research find out about the kind of man that he was?
Well, his training was just extraordinary. I mean, he's what we would call in junior high school, and he's having to study about five different languages, mathematics, different sciences, military sciences, the various arts. He did woodworking. I mean, these sort of peasant skills he also had to learn on top of this. He was supposed to be very well-rounded. Nicholas had come to the throne almost by accident. He was the second son. He never imagined he was going to have to do anything, so he didn't try very hard to figure out what was going on. And when he wound up there, he realized his son had better be better educated than he was. So he made sure he was very well educated. When Mark Twain visited, for instance, the Tsar spoke English to him. Everyone spoke English in the palace. They could speak English quite well. One of his daughters, in fact, did marry one of Victoria's sons and became the Duchess of Edinburgh. But so there was a good close connection there. But it was still he's described as being very cautious in a lot of ways and somewhat worried looking all the time. I think he realized the giant powder keg he was sitting on as the Tsar of Russia under Catherine the Great or, Peter the Great. Nobody sneezed in Europe without Russia's permission. And this began to fall apart somewhat under the reign of Nicholas. And by the time that Alexander comes to the throne, Europe has modernized. They've all gotten rid of their serfs. And they have modern weapons. They have, you know, modern ships. And Russia is way behind the time on a lot of this stuff. So he had to double up and really get Russia into the 19th century, as it were. And he did a lot of that. The amount of railroads and telegraph lines expanded exponentially during his reigns. The number of independent corporations and their capital assets grew enormously while he was there.
So did he sort of read the tea leaves, so to speak, because he ended serfdom, essentially slavery. And was it because of this growing dissent among poor Russians, or was he motivated by a true belief that owning people, other people, wasn't right?
Well, I think you have those two work together. He was much more liberal than his father had been. His father, like I said, it was a terrible, terrible time to be alive and try to be creative in Russia. Alexander, the first things he did was to reform, establish freedom of the press, freedom of speech, emancipation of the Jews who had been, you know, restricted to certain areas where they could live. He modernized the court system, which was unbelievably pre-medieval, and the legal system, the church, the educational system. He was in all of these things trying to get Russia sort of up to speed with the rest of the world because he had seen the Crimean War, what happens when Russia was not prepared. Mm-hmm. This was a major, major war where Russia was fighting with antiquated weapons against the best armies in the world. And their men fought valiantly. A lot of blood was spilled, but they could not fight against the bigger cannons. And so he wanted to make sure that they had the best of everything if they were going to go back to war, which was always on the back of the mind, I think, when you're the head of state. But at the same time, he also was, I mean, among part of his education was poetry, literature. He absorbed a great deal of the works of the German scholars, Goethe and so forth, Schiller, who were always about independence and liberty and this sort of thing. So he understood a lot of that, and he certainly understood where the rest of Europe was coming from. Europe had ended slavery. They're not slavery. Well, serfdom. Slavery, kind of a different story there. But serfdom had ended by the time he came to the throne. And basically because it led to rebellions, but also mechanization and better farming techniques were coming in that made serfs cost ineffective.
And so he took advantage of that.
He saw that as well. But he also he told his nobles, he said, the present system of owning human souls cannot continue to exist. It's better to liberate the serfs from above rather than wait for the time when they will force it themselves from below. There were incidents that were always happening in Russia. Every year there's a registry of how many peasant incidents occurred, and they were, you know, often had to be put down with force, and they were
increasing.
And they were there was a deal of rebellion going on there, and he wanted to try and staunch that if at all possible.
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you'd like to call in with questions about Tsar Alexander II, the man behind the deal to sell what was then known as Russian America, and sell that territory that became Alaska to the United States. We're talking about that book, Tsar, the Man Who Sold Alaska, with author Mike Dunham. And then in the second half of the program, we're going to talk about William H. Seward, the man who bought the territory. There is a slideshow on our website. If you'd like to go to alaskapublic.org, you can see a lot of amazing photos that Mike has compiled as part of his research, and are also many of the photos that are featured in the book. So you can go to alaskapublic.org and take a look at those if you'd like. Against the backdrop of the tensions, I'm kind of hopping around here,
sure.
But the backdrop of the tensions and sort of weird Russia connections being examined today, there's a line that stands out from 1863 when Russian warships were in New York and San Francisco, and the Secretary of the Navy said, "Thank God for the Russians."
Yeah, Gideon Wells, Secretary of the Union went into the Civil War with, well, the South went into the Civil War with no Navy whatsoever, and the Union had just a couple of ships. We weren't worried about naval warfare in the 1850s, and Congress, Seward being part of that, had refused to grant extra military funds for fear that Buchanan would use them to support the pro-slavery forces. That's one of the reasons, but probably other political reasons as well, mm-hmm. that sort of escape us. There was a great fear that France or Britain, or possibly both of them, would jump into the Civil War on the side of the South. And if they did that, that was it for the Union. We could not have beaten the British Navy, probably couldn't have beaten the French Navy for that matter. But all of a sudden, unannounced, uninvited apparently, you get two big fleets of Russian warships, state-of-the-art. Alexander had been modernizing his military, show up in New York and San Francisco at the same time, and everyone's delighted by this. Mary Todd Lincoln takes a tour of the fleet. Like I said, the Secretary of Navy was delighted to see, you know, someone show up like this. And Seward, who was famous for his fabulous parties, invited all the Russian officers to one of these big whoop-de-doo things there in Washington, D.C., and it was it created goodwill, probably a high point of goodwill between our two countries. And for most of the 19th century, we were fine with the Russians.
It's amazing how complex and intertwined these histories are, and that's one of the things that really stood out to me was, for those who haven't researched the long and complicated relationship between the U.S. and Russia, there's some really good moments in your writings about those things. We're going to go to the phones. Steve is in Fairbanks. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Good morning. I read something recently. I can't exactly recall where, that somehow Mary Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's widow, was involved with some of these major players in the purchase of Alaska. I was wondering if Mr. Dunham knew anything about that. Thank you.
Thanks.
And I do not. I have not found reference. She was clearly, you know, in charge of a lot of parties when she was feeling well enough to do it, and it was a very important role for the female relatives of heads of state to be in charge of these things and to, you know, fly the flag, so to speak. She definitely entertained the Russians when they showed up with their fleets. I'm not aware of anything she did after the assassination. You know, she departed the White House and seems to have, you know, some sort of floated out of the Washington, D.C. nightlife, which was, or, you know, the social scene there, which was taking its own course after Lincoln's assassination.
Maybe someone needs to research that historical looking into Mary Todd Lincoln after the White House.
There are excellent biographies of her life, which are available out there, and very, very big, full biographies. These are quite short books, of course, and there's a lot that is missing. I have to admit that up front.
But you've also packed a lot in there. It's impressive. I'm still in the first book, but there's a lot of great history in the writing that you've put together. Both books have kind of a subtitle, The World's Best Real Estate Deal. But Russians didn't see it that way. How did Alexander II sell the idea to them before he closed the deal with the U.S.?
Oh, he didn't. He didn't have to. He was a czar. What he said went, but it was, he was talking to his advisors what he wanted to do, and most of them were opposed to the letting go of the colony. They wanted to keep it there, and most Russians were very proud to have this offshore possession. It put them in the same league as France and Britain, all these other countries that were always, blowing their own horn, and they could be proud of themselves as an international power. It was proof that you had it there. When it went through, there was no press release. There was no announcement from the Russian Foreign Office at all. The Russians had to learn about it in their newspapers, which picked it up from European newspapers, and they were not happy.
Probably didn't go over well.
They were not happy about it all, and still are not. There was an admiral who was cashiered, essentially drummed out of the service for talking about it too loudly, and the czar threatened publishers of newspapers with charges of sedition if they didn't tone down their nasty remarks. Edward de Steckel, the Russian ambassador who had arranged, been the point man in the sale for the Russians, was expecting a big promotion. He was going to be the minister to The Hague, the most important position in Europe, and instead he was pensioned off and sent to live in southern France with his wife, who was a Bostonian, by the way. And one American historian says that 100 years later, he could find no mention of de Steckel in any Russian reference book at all. And the Russian historian Edward Radzinski, and he has he has the one Russian language biography of Alexander that's been translated into English. He spends a whole page and a half, if that much, on the sale of Alaska. And he says, the sale of Alaska is the one thing for which Russians have still not forgiven Alexander
II. 1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 550-8422. 550-8422 is the number in Anchorage if you'd like to call in with questions or comments. talk@alaskapublic.org is the email address if you want to send your questions in that way. The sale was negotiated through a treaty. Is that the common way that these major land transactions between countries would have been handled, or is it because there were people that were living here and also had legitimate claim to this territory?
It's a state-to-state transaction, so it required a treaty, and for the United States, that meant the Senate had to ratify it. That's the way things were done. The Louisiana Purchase is essentially a treaty between the United States and France. The Mexican Cession is a treaty between Mexico and the United States. And this is more or less the language that was being used at the time like that. And the Treaty of Cession did say that the quote-unquote civilized residents, meaning you lived in a steady place and were not a nomad, this is more like a Russian idea than an American one, I think, would have full rights as American citizens if they wanted it. They had 3 years to decide if they wanted to be Americans or move back to Russia. So that was looked at, but it was pretty well abrogated. You could have all the civil rights you wanted as an American citizen in Sitka, but there were no courts. There was no civil government at all for many years after that. So it was there were a lot of T's and I's that weren't quite dotted and crossed as you walked into this. Neither Seward or de Steckel knew anything about Alaska when you get right down to it. They had no idea what was up here and what the situation was. And if they'd just asked any of the Russian governors, they probably could have gotten a much more, a clearer view of what was necessary. One of the first things that happened after the purchase was known was that a group of Tlingit chiefs brought a court suit in Washington, D.C., saying, you think you misunderstood the arrangement we had with the Russians. And it was pretty well overlooked. It was just, yeah, never no, you know, be quiet. You belong to Uncle Sam.
Such interesting tidbits that emerge out of that history. And we had an email question about from someone in Talkeetna saying, one of the largest Russian legacies in Alaska is the Russian Orthodox religion. Talk a little bit about the role of that in our lead up to the break here.
Well, the Orthodox Church was, they'd sent the first missionaries to Alaska in the 1700s, I think, and established churches around the place. Many of the Russian ministers and priests and even lay clergy were of mixed race, and provided this sort of connection between the government, the official government of Russia, and the people who lived in Alaska. And there was this unique sort of bourgeois Creole class. Lydia Black writes about this in her book, Russians in Alaska, Russians in America, and which developed, which was really, really quite impressive. It was not like what was happening in the Wild West or with the Eastern Indian tribes in America. It was a totally different animal, very Russian animal. Village life sort of took on this thing, and this is why we have a lot of people in Alaska now with Russian last names, and the Russian churches spread throughout the area. The Russian churches were seen as sort of the protectors of the people in some way, the voice that would speak out if the civil authorities were too strong. They were also the ones who administered smallpox vaccinations. Mm. this is a big thing. And Seward had a daughter who died from smallpox. And this did not happen in areas of Alaska that had Orthodox churches. So they were. It was definitely a very strong part of what was going on. There was also they helped establish orphanages, hospitals, and schools. However, Anna Furuheim, the wife of the second to last Russian governor, says that it was interesting. The one book they weren't allowed to read was the Bible, and that was the one they were most interested in. That was some sort of church rule, I presume, but. She was a Protestant herself and was a little offended by this, but there were no Protestant churches in Russian America at all. It was all Orthodox Church. Finally, there were enough Finns that they had to allow the Finns to have a Lutheran church in Sitka, and that was the only Protestant church in the territory at the time.
Let's go to the phones quickly before our break. Julie is in Anchorage. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
Do you have a quick question?
Well, I just wondered why Alexander wanted to get rid of Russian America. Why did he want to sell?
And that's the $54,000 question right there. Once again, there was no press release. There's been a long-running theory that he needed the money to pay back the debts on the Crimean War, but that had taken place 10 years before, or that he was otherwise deeply in debt. But the country was sort of always deeply in debt. But his private accounts had many, many times $7.2 million. It was not that it was a desperate need to get cash. His brother, Constantine, was very opposed to Russian America. He thought it was a drag on the resources of the country. He was very interested in developing Siberia, and he was constantly saying this, get rid of North America. It's a liability. And it was something of a liability. In the Crimean War, British and French forces fought Russians just a few miles from Attu in Petropavlovsk on the Kamchatka Peninsula. And then in the middle of the Civil War, actually at the very end of the Civil War, or after the Civil War, a Confederate raider went into the Bering Sea and sank the whole Yankee whaling fleet and burned up a fortune in whale oil. And the fear was, if a small warship could do this much damage, what might a real Navy do if they wanted to take it from us? So there was an interest in not having it just taken, but get something for it.
All right. Thanks for the call, Julie. We are going to take a quick break. And after the break, we'll switch gears into the American side of this enormous real estate transaction and discuss William H. Seward as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. My guest today is Mike Dunham, longtime reporter in Alaska and now the author of two new books about the real estate transaction that took place when Alaska switched hands from Russia to the United States. The first book that we discussed in the first half of the program is called The Man Who Sold Alaska, Tsar Alexander II of Russia. Here's what it looks like for those of you in TV land. And now we are transitioning to the second book, The Man Who Bought Alaska, William H. Seward. And here's what that book looks like for those of you in TV land. William Henry Seward. If we back up to his youth, his family had slaves, but Seward's father allowed them to attend school with young William. How do you think his young life sort of shaped who he became and what he believed in? Because he had very strong thoughts about this later on.
He did. And one of the wonderful things, resources I had while writing these books was his own biography of his early years. And he talks about his boyhood in great detail, down to his toddlerhood almost. And it was interesting. They had slaves, but it was not necessarily plantation slavery. These people were house servants, by and large, or field hands who helped there. They lived basically in the house with the family. And Seward often said he much preferred the company in the kitchen than to the company in the parlor, which is where his family would have been entertaining people. His father was quite an important man in this little community. And Seward himself was enthralled with the pageants and the parades at the 4th of July. And he mentioned a play, Cato, by Addison, which convinced him that monarchy was always going to be wrong and republicanism was the right way of the future. America is all of 15 years old when he's born. And there are many veterans of the Revolutionary War there at that time. And by the time he's, still a boy, the War of 1812 has broken out. He's 10 years old, and he's rooting for Napoleon and cheering when he thinks that Canada has been conquered by the United States. I'm very depressed when it didn't work out that way. But he said he became very enthusiastic about his native land at that point in time.
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide if you have a question about William Henry Seward, the man who bought Alaska. 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. The year after William Seward was born, Tlingits in southeast Alaska destroyed Russian strongholds in Yakutat and Sitka.
And Sitka, yeah. The first battle of Sitka, led by Katrin, the Sitka leader, and really, chased them out. It took Baranov 2 years to get an armed force together, and then just sheer luck having a Russian warship show up at the same time. And it wasn't even really a warship, but in the tactics of the time, having a mobile platform with cannons was very, very critical. It played a huge role in the Civil War many years later, and for that matter, in World War II. Mm-hmm. Then Baranov came back, and took over the settlement again. Now there are two different versions to this story. One is the one we often receive, which was that the Russians bombarded them until they fled. And the other is, this is from Herb Hope, former grand president of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, who I used to have pie with over at Leroy's with some regularity. And he described in great detail how the Tlingits carefully evacuated the town as their supplies began to run out and they realized it was futile to stay there, and then set up a camp on the other end of the island and sort of created a blockade against Baranov until a deal could be reached. And at the end of the day, Baranov and Katrin became allies. The Tlingits providing the furs, the Russians providing the cash and trade goods and arranging for the shipment of them out there. And a period of great prosperity ensued. When Baranov was finally ordered out, he gave his chained armor. He had a suit of mail. He gave that to Katlin as a goodbye gift. And one of the Tlingit chiefs gave one of the Russians Katlin's various weapons that had been used in the Battle of Sitka. And it was a very interesting arrangement that proceeded after that.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Kathleen is in Anchorage. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi there, how's it going?
Good. Did you have a question?
Yeah, one quick question, actually, just two. I was wondering if you guys could talk more about different court rulings for the purchase of Alaska, specifically between Alaska Natives and the United States. I think there's one example. It's called Tlingit and Haida Indians of Alaska versus United States. So if you could talk about those court rulings and the end results of those court rulings, that'd be awesome information to learn. And then also, I heard that, this is just something I've heard, but I heard that the Tlingit received a check for the purchase and they never cashed it. So I was wondering if you knew anything about that as well. Anyways, thank you so much.
Interesting. Well, yeah. Thanks, Kathleen.
Yeah, and in order, these books pretty well stop with the deaths of the principal people that I'm writing about. They're quite short books. The Haida Tlingit versus the United States is a case that I think is brought much later in the 20th century. There are excellent books on this subject as well. One quite recent one from the University of Alaska Press is has just come out, and it's called Seward's Folly. It specifically looks at the sale and the aftermath. That's one principal source. It's quite recent, and there are other large things there. As far as I know, however, no check was ever issued to the Native people of Alaska during the period that the books cover. So,
interesting though how these things get started, and it's good to get those questions out there. So thanks for the call, Kathleen. Amy is in Nome. Hi, Amy.
Hi, just a quick question and a comment. You always hear that saying, which I've always loved, that the Tsar is back in Russia and God is even farther away. And I was curious to know what level of authority the governors in Alaska had deferred to them and what the chain of command was that linked them back all the way to the Tsar. And then the comment, I'll take that answer off there, but the comment that I wanted to make is I always think the most fascinating piece of this is how Alaska, as it was sold, was far more territory than Russian America truly was, since it wasn't really colonized up to the areas like where I live in Nome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Amy.
That's so true. The Russians really never had a fort further than St. Michael's, maybe Nulato. You can put it in that context. It was a long communications route. This was one of the big problems I think Russia had with it. You couldn't get here overland. Eventually, you had to use ships. And the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea were considered so dangerous that they would actually send ships from St. Petersburg through the Atlantic all the way around Cape Horn and then the Pacific to reach, or the other direction, around Africa to reach Alaska. And that's how they were serviced. It became very convenient to use American ships at that point. The Yankee sailing ships took over a lot of the trade between Russian America and Hawaii and China, which is where they were making their money. The governors themselves were essentially government appointees. They were government civil servants, if you will, usually from the Navy towards the end of things, and also employees of the Russian American Fur Company, which had a charter to gather the resources available here. The Russian American Fur Company and the Hudson Bay Company had sat down at some point and declared a truce that they wouldn't poach on each other's lands, so to speak, or interfere with each other's business. And that's why we have this long straight line running down the border between between the Arctic Ocean and Yakutat, basically, going through territory that no Russian or Brit had ever seen at the time they drew the line. And I think it's also worth noting, however, that the Alaska-Canada border is the longest international border in the world that has never been crossed by an army at war.
That was an interesting bit of detail. I remember you talking about that the other day. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and my guest today is Mike Dunham. Mike is a longtime reporter in Alaska, and he is the author of two new books about the purchase, the 150th anniversary, the sesquicentennial of the purchase of Alaska from Russia. The two books are The Man Who Sold Russia, Tsar Alexander II of Russia, and The Man Who Bought Alaska, William H. Seward. I love the scene in the book. We talked, for those of you just joining us, we talked about the Tsar in the first half of the program. We're talking about William Seward now. I love the scene in the book about William Seward finding out that Russia was willing to sell what was called Russian America over a game of whist. Seward quit playing cards to get the treaty deal done that same night. This is a vivid scene. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we're talking the night of March 29th, 1867. Almost, we're coming up, that'll be Wednesday, 150 years ago, tomorrow. And it's late at night, like 10 or 11 at night. He was kind of a night owl, and loved card games, and he was just sitting there gambling away, smoking cigars and chatting with his family about probably doing most of the talking. And there's a knock at the door, which was apparently not unexpected in better neighborhoods at that time of our history. And in comes the ambassador from Russia, and he said, "I just received word from the Tsar who approves the sale." They'd been talking about this for some time. "And I can come by tomorrow and settle it all up if that's convenient for you." Seward shoves the table away and says, "Let's do it right now." They get their staffs together, their translators and their secretaries together, and they sit back and they hash out the deal, write up the document. And by about 4 or 5 in the morning on the 30th of March, it is signed, and Seward rushes it over to the White House, where Andrew Johnson signs off on it. Then he rushes it over to the Senate, which is just about to adjourn for the session. And they're all sitting there basically coming up with one piece of legislation to make Andrew Jackson mad. And when he walks in, they're a little disgusted with the whole idea. But he shakes the paper and he says, "A treaty for the cession of Russian America." And everybody gasps, except for Charles Sumner, the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, who'd been in on the deal the whole time. And he says, "I propose we reconvene in 3 days to discuss this matter." And everybody agrees. Everyone was delighted with the idea, by the way. It passed 37-2 in the Senate. And that gives you an idea. The whole idea of Seward's folly is something of a myth.
Interesting.
Recent historians have made that pretty clear. Most of America was all for it. Bret Hart wrote a poem for the San Francisco's paper as soon as the news hit there.
So was it some political adversary of Seward's that created there's
a lot of politics that runs through Seward, and you can't get to the tall weeds of New York State politics in the 1840s. It can get pretty confusing. But slavery was not the big issue in America in those days. The big issue was who was going to be the head of the New York Customs agent, which controlled all of these jobs, and that was a real bloodbath. Anyway, Seward's idea here was to try and sort of frame out Britain. He thought that Canada and the United States were going to become one big happy country. Sooner or later, Alaska would kind of complete the set. He loved the idea of this great circle route, which goes through Alaska, actually, connecting the shortest route between California and Asia. And it wasn't such a bad deal. There were some of his enemies, and he had many enemies, but some of them, throughout this is a bad idea. There was still a certain amount of resistance to gaining more useless territory for the United States at that time, and especially for spending money. It would have been a bigger issue a few years later when we hit a depression. But right then, spirits were up, and people were all for it. And it showed up in a few papers, which then picked it up from other newspapers, and Alaskans seemed to be more excited by the idea of Seward's folly than anyone else, because it makes us seem like, oh, we're so poor, everybody hates us, they thought we were stupid, and we've sort of continued it more than it probably needed to be continued. But most of the country was all for the acquisition of more useless territory.
I want to go back to the phones here in a second, but before we do that, we had an email comment. How is the sale and purchase of land wrongly claimed by Russia? How does it remain legal? The land was already occupied by indigenous people, the Alaska Native people that were here. The question is, does might make law?
Well, often it does. As a matter of fact, in cases of war and guns and battleships. But this is an aspect of international law that is really beyond my scope. Once again, there are very large volumes, many large volumes dealing with claims by one country or another, and legions of court cases that have been filed on this. It's a subject that's very interesting, but on the other hand, very dense and thick. Mm-hmm. We sort of, you know, move past that. I mean, it's usually when money changes hands and there's a piece of paper, then all of a sudden.
And there's big militaries potentially involved. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Harry is in Klawak.
Oh.
Hi, Harry.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to talk about the Klingits and the Russians. I heard you guys talking a while ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there is a book out. It's called Anushi Klingit, Anika. It's Russians in Klingit America.
It is a great book. I used that book extensively in these. Herb Hope had some pieces in there, but other things. It is one of the best Alaska history books I have ever seen.
Exactly. And I was going to talk about that. It's by Richard and Nora Donhauer. And I just found out recently that my grandfather's people were the Kiksati from my mother's side.
Okay.
So it was, but I was just letting you know about the book mainly, and hopefully, well, that you just said it. You got a lot of information from it.
Yeah, I'm so glad you called and brought that up, Harry.
Yeah, I mean, I got to give them a plug. What Nora and Richard did, they got oral histories from everyone they possibly could. They looked at every document they possibly could from the time. They include it all. And it's not actually hard reading, but you can find out what everybody was saying and what has been remembered from that time forward. And it's fascinating.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call, Harry. I'm glad that you raised the topic of the book so that Mike Dunham could let us know a little more about it. We are discussing the sale and purchase of Alaska today, and as two new books by Mike Dunham are profiling both men on either side of this land transaction. We're going to take a short break and we'll continue this conversation and take your calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're going to go right back to the phones. Chansey is in Anchorage. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to congratulate Michael. This is a great effort on his part, and it's obvious that he did a tremendous amount of research on it. Slight bit of bad news of the two large bookstores. One doesn't have it because it's not buying new books. Barnes & Noble has a Seward and expects to have Alexander in 10 days or so, something like that.
But, you can only buy one half of the set.
I went right out to get it. I'm quite excited about it. And I think it's a great job that you've done there, Michael, and a real contribution. I just wanted to follow up a bit in terms of negotiating on the question of land claims. In effect, as I understand it in real estate terms, and I'm not a real estate lawyer, basically Russia just sold whatever title it had to America and said, as far as any indigenous claims are concerned, it's up to the United States to accept the responsibility for that. Is that kind of the way the negotiations went or not?
Yeah, and I'm not an expert on this by any means, but I've always looked at it that way. Yeah, Russia sort of sold America 12 trading posts and the stock on the shelves, when Willie Hensley, you know, went back and looked at the original document and found that this sort of gaping hole is what led to our contemporary Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act in my lifetime. So it is, once again, it's an element of law, and I couldn't argue a parking ticket if I had to. So it's not really my area of expertise, but it is, that's why I'm trying to be very careful with this. It's the acquisition of Russian claims to North America.
Right. But
now, after gold was discovered, you had this huge push westward from the United States. We had the largest standing army on the face of the earth with the most modern weapons. You know, it was, you know, that was that.
It was kind of the U.S. way or the highway at that point in time.
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said, military power counts for a whole lot. And you can, you know, the nationalist Chinese will tell you all about this.
Mm-hmm. Chancey, thanks so much for the call. We are going to continue on with the phones so we can fit a few more calls in. Kristen is in Anchor Point. Hi, Kristen.
Hey, hi.
Did you have a question?
Yeah. Well, first, I just wanted to say that I've been to Florida, New York, and I've seen William Seward's place. It's a museum. The people of New York, especially in the Florida area, consider him one of their greatest statesmen because he was, he was in the New York legislature and Senate. He served the state of New York, as I believe, also as their Secretary of State. I don't remember if he was elected governor, but I think he did have some.
Yeah, he was when he was 37 years old.
37 years old, yeah. I hadn't been there since I went in the late 1980s because my brother moved there and said, oh, you got to come. You got to come to this place. This is where Seward came from. So I came. It's a beautiful, beautiful town just near the border of New York and New Jersey. Have you actually gone and seen his place?
I didn't get to Florida. I did go to Auburn, where the Seward House Museum is, and that's that was his mailing address for most of his life when he wasn't in Washington, D.C. And it, too, is kept as a marvelous museum. It's in Auburn, New York. I went there because his papers are kept at the University of Rochester, not far away, and I wanted to go through those with some attention to detail about what he had to say about Alaska.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Kristen. Let's stick with the phones for a moment. Stu is in Anchorage. Hi, Stu.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mike, could you talk about how the boundaries were decided specifically with the islands, starting from the north with Wrangell? Then you got the Diomedes, right? They have Big Diomedes. We got Little Diomedes. St. Lawrence Island, Pribilof, then why didn't we get the Kormodorskis too? Was there occupation by the Russians already at that period on the Kormodorskis?
I have no idea about the Kormodorskis. I think it had something to do with the proximities to the mainland of all of this. The eastern border of Alaska was set by the tops of the mountain ranges, essentially. I mean, Russia had the coast, and whatever was beyond the mountains would be left to the Hudson Bay Company. And then, right about Yakutat or so, they didn't know what was there. They just drew a straight line and decided that would be their common border. But it did keep Alaska out of the Crimean War just barely. We probably would have been attacked in Sitka and Kodiak by the Russian. By the British and the French. If the Russian American and the Hudson Bay companies hadn't cut this deal and told their respective governments, stay out of it. We don't need this here. Just, you know, we'll keep giving you money, but just don't bring your war over
to us.
Sounds
like extortion.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was it.
All right, thanks for the call, Stu. Let's stay with another call here. Gary is in Juneau. Hi, Gary.
Howdy, Lori. Hey, I'm way too blabby to comment on such a great show, so I just made a couple of notes here that I'd like Mike at the end of the show to talk about websites or anything like that where we can access him and a list of references, like a reading list of his wonderful historical spectrum that he's explored. I worked with Larry Golden on the film The Land is Ours and just wanted to mention some other luminaries whose names I hadn't heard on the show. That would be Rosita Worrell, who just retired as the chief
yes.
of Southeast Alaska Heritage Institute or Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. Steve Haycox, who is a wonderful historian we worked on the film with, and Larry Golden, who lives up in Girdwood, who was the filmmaker. And thank you very much for taking a call. Wonderful show. I would love to hear a follow-up, Mike, sometime exclusively devoted to the Tuxedi Survival March. Talk to you all later.
Thank you, Gary. And we do have the books on our website, alaskapublic.org. There's also, as I mentioned earlier in the show, there's a great slideshow of Mike's photos that are featured in the book. So there's more information there. And Mike... maybe you, is there other places that people can find it online?
Or? Well, no, actually, your website's going to be about this. I do not have a website set up on this. These have just now come out. A bibliography of the books that I used are at the back of both books. I was hoping I could get an index in, but the time crunch didn't allow that to happen. Hopefully in the second edition we'll have that.
All right. So how do you think world events may have unfolded if the U.S. had not purchased Alaska from Russia?
Ooh, that's a question I always love to ask people when I make the presentation. What do you think would have happened? Would Russia have been able to hold on to its colonies and perhaps extend it and build on it? Would there be a mixed-race bourgeois Creole class in Alaska that was actually the dominant population and the movers and shakers? Or would Britain ultimately have just sucked it into Canada? There are all these different theories about what would have happened. And I don't know about that. I do know this, that, you know, the night that Lincoln was assassinated, collaborators tried to kill Seward at the same time. If it had worked out that Lincoln had lived and Seward had died, the Civil War probably would have ended a little more calmly than happened. I think Lincoln was a greater reconciler than Andrew Johnson was. But I don't know for sure that America would have acquired Alaska. I think Seward's very quick action, his alertness to the situation on the night of March 29th, 1867, made something possible that might not have happened. If it had been delayed, the Senate had not been in session, by the time they got back into session, moods could have changed. And the votes might not have been there.
How interesting. We only have about a minute or so left. And my last question, a little tongue-in-cheek, I must say. President Trump is a real estate mogul who has said numerous times, wouldn't it be nice if we could get along with Russia? Russia would probably like Alaska back. Are we at risk, Mike?
I don't think so. One thing, it's a piece of paper. I mean, it's a sign. It wasn't taken by force. It wasn't taken by trickery at the diplomatic table. Say what you will about Ivan, they usually respect their deals when they've cut the deal. They may not like it, but there we are. I don't think we're any worried with that. But it does raise the subtitle of both books is The World's Best Real Estate Deal. That's not my idea. That was the publisher's idea. I'm not sure it is the world's best thing, but I noticed it gets quoted a lot, so I think he probably had the right idea.
All right. Well, thanks so much to my guest, Mike Dunham. He is the author of two new books, The Man Who Sold Russia and The Man Who Bought, The Man Who Sold Alaska, Tsar Alexander II of Russia, and The Man Who Bought Alaska, William H. Seward. You can find more on our website, alaskapublic.org. There's a slideshow of a lot of photos there, and more information about the two books. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.